from every quarter, from the north, south, east, and west, to clear the way to freedom for the land we love the best. We've left our occupation and home so far and near, but when the going's rather rough, we raise this song of cheer. Good morning, Mr. Zip, 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 with your haircut just as short as mine. Good morning, Mr. Zip, 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 you're surely looking fine. Ashes to ashes and dust to dust, if the camels don't get you, the fatima's must. Good morning, Mr. Zip, 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 with your haircut just as short as, your haircut just as short as, haircut just as short as mine. Good morning, Mr. Zip, Zip, Zip.
The song you're hearing right now was very important in the life of our guest, Richard Schickel. Indeed, it is in the title of his new book, which is Good Morning, Mr. Zip, 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 subtitled Movies, Memory, and World War II. Richard Schickel, of course, is one of our best-known movie critics. He's more than that. He's a movie scholar. He's done not only regular reviews for Time magazine since time immemorial, he's also done many very important books on film, and he now does documentaries about the history of film. And we should explain why a song from World War One gives you the title for your new book.
It's really very simple. Prior to World War II, when I was, 4 or 5 years old, it was a song my father used to sing me to sleep with. It was a nonsense song. It was funny. I had no idea what a Fatima or probably I knew what a camel was, but Fatima was a lost brand by then. But I just thought it was funny, and I'd sort of giggle and snuggle down into my little bed. And he also sometimes sang a song you may remember since you went to Wisconsin, If You Want to Be a Badger.
I copied that in your book, but I didn't know that
really?
When I was a kid.
Prior to World War One song, mm-hmm. It was kind of a courting song, take your ukulele and your canoe and your, coonskin coat out on Lake Mendota and sing to the girl. So those were little songs that somehow came into my head when I was writing this book, which one of the things that is interesting about writing a memoir is once you start writing it, the mind starts playing that trick. It starts associating. And I found, just remembering all kinds of things that you had no idea were in your head. And so it was, in that way, that was the adventure, in a way, of the book. I certainly didn't have Good Morning, Mr. Zip, Zip, Zip in my mind when I started writing that book, but somehow it popped in my head and other associations in the same way. So I guess if you want to write a memoir, you should have kind of a free-ranging memory, a memory that you kind of just let go. And there's all kinds of stuff I remembered I didn't put in the book, but it's that's the fun of this kind of book.
This is a fine American memoir. It does indeed evoke a time of comparative innocence, or at least an innocent place and an innocent kid.
A real innocent kid, yeah, that's for sure.
And a very different world. But, of course, it is also anchored in, the memoir is, in movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, my very first movie was Snow White and Seven Dwarfs.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was 1937. So I was about 4 years old. Maybe I saw it when I was five, late in the run. There's something that attracted me to the movies in the act of going to the movies. In other words, I think if you're going to become what Time magazine used to call a cinema addict, a cinema addict, that is, I think you need the mystery of the darkened room, the big screen, which is almost mm-hmm. like a window you're voyeuristically peering into. There was in those days, because movie theaters themselves, even the neighborhood theaters, were quite rich in decor and kind of secondhand glamour.
Great Oriental palaces, most
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, Oriental, Deco,
yeah.
French Provincial, you name it, modern. There
well,
were a lot of modern
my movie
theater
was the Lowy's Oriental
uh-huh.
in Bensonhurst in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And that, obviously by its very name, was done up in kind of pseudo-Moorish, they called it.
That's right. Moorish was big in those days. Yeah. Atmospheric theaters, they were called, mm-hmm. because they attempted to recreate an Arabic or an Oriental or whatever atmosphere as you entered the house. Anyway, I think I became addicted to movies as the occasions they were in those days before I per se became addicted to particular movies.
Well, as a kid, you would go to them at the very beginning. Your initiation, yeah, as it was for you, is with your parents.
Sure.
An important family.
Oh, yes. And, of course, going to that movie, because it was so widely well-received, mm-hmm, you know. I mean, people really in those days thought of Disney as a genius.
Wasn't Snow White the first full-length?
Full-length animated feature, yes.
It was called cartoon film.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Similarly, the other large occasion that I recall where there was a lot of parental buzz and, mm-hmm, and excitement at taking me to the movie was in 1940 when Chaplin's The Great Dictator came out. Now, that picture at the time kind of sailed over my head. There were some gags in it I remembered.
Mm-hmm. You remember him waltzing with the world? The big
balloon? Yeah, sure. And I remember the funny stuff with the Big Bertha gun that doesn't work, yeah, you know, and then it finally launches a shell and it hits an outhouse.
But you didn't have enough of a sense of who Hitler was, I suppose.
No, I think not. And I think, you know, Chaplin really was quite a subtle comedian. Hmm. And he was still in that film, it's the last film, where he really built these nice long lines of gags. But I didn't, you know, it's only really recently when I've been making a film about Charlie Chaplin, as I told you before we went on the air, and it's really making that film in the last year that has made me kind of a huge Chaplin fan. I mean, he really was an amazing figure in films. But the point I was trying to make was my parents took me to that almost as if they were taking me to the opera or the symphony. They were introducing me to one of the finer things in life as they conceived it to be. And they were not wrong, I have now determined, you know, that Chaplin is one of the finer things.
Do a what if. What if we got into the technology of television and DVDs or whatever you call them and all of that stuff,
yeah,
50 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way one saw movies in those, uh-huh, days. Would you have been as hooked by film if you saw them on television screens at home?
I suspect not. I think too. The largeness of theaters, the largeness of screens,
mm-hmm,
the fact that, you know, most films in those days were black and white, I think makes a difference. You know, black and white has a sort of works on the human eye and sensorium or whatever you want to call it, I think much differently than color.
Do you ever try looking at a film on television to take the color dial and,
oh, sure,
turn back to so you get, yeah, it in black and white, though, yeah, it's made in color?
Yeah.
I rather enjoy doing
that. I find it's one of the things that I find dismaying today, where I've had young people say to me, well, I've never seen a black and white film.
Hmm.
Or I would avoid seeing a black. Oh, I wouldn't want to see that. And you say, you don't understand. The grayscale was wonderful. It's infinitely subtler than flat color film.
Yet years ago, Ted Turner almost ruined it. He developed a process called colorization. They would take all the classic black and white films and turn them into color. And I guess they did for a number of them.
But boy, did that go away fast.
I'm glad it did.
Turner classic movies, for which I have made a number of documentaries, they don't. They laugh. They say, well, we've got it in color or black and white. You say, color? Well, I don't think so.
The theme of your book, in a way, is given in an excerpt I will ask you to read. I've marked it right here on this page, the bottom of the one page and then on to the top of the next page. And out come the reading glasses. And
right.
We can go.
I'm sure I would have liked the movies if the war had not happened, but I think I would have liked them in the same way that other people do, as a diversion they can pretty much take or leave. I do not think they would have gotten into my head as they did if they had not had the war as their great subject. Not enjoyed the unique reciprocity between this overwhelming reality and its heroic, deadly, inspiring representations in this powerful and omnipresent medium. Yeah, I honestly think that the war was almost, for a kid, not for grown-ups, but for a kid, it was almost an alternative reality. It was also the biggest epic anybody had ever conceived on a movie screen or in a book or anything like it. And there it was, as a kind of omnipresent reality that control things big and small in our lives. The boy down the block might be drafted and go to the South Pacific and come home wounded. On the or we would be making little balls of
tinfoil
yeah. and saving them in our kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Or we would be digging our little victory garden, or saving up our pennies for war stamps, or
and cuddling up to the radio to listen to Franklin radio. Roosevelt.
Yeah. That, and but also cuddling up to the radio to listen to Fibber McGee and Molly and all those great radio shows. So I think that the war gave to movies a sort of overriding import, since so many movies were about the war. They glamorized it. They made it something huge, something larger than life, although the movies of the war, particularly combat movies, tended to show the ordinariness of American soldiers, who could rise then to extraordinary heroic heights when the pressure was on them.
We have that mix in many of those movies. You're right about this. All the guys in the squad,
mm-hmm.
and they represent supposedly
oh, yeah.
every category
Brooklyn
of the
Jews,
American.
Texas cowboys, WASP kids off the farm in Iowa, and somehow they all got in the same platoon.
And there's always, or usually there is, yeah. an older guy, I guess he's a sergeant,
yeah.
Who's weathered and wise.
Immortally played slightly after the war by George Murphy in Battleground. Remember, uh-huh. he's the old guy he's got foot troubles, and he's always looking for a pair of dry socks, and, you know, he's the complaining older guy. The other thing that was always present in that platoon was a guy who wasn't quite altogether committed to the war in the same way the other guys were. He was cynical. If it was a movie about the beginning of the war, it was always that his enlistment was going to be up, as it would turn out to be, December 8th, 1941. And the movie was often, one of the subtexts of the movie would be getting this guy onto the team, yeah. onto the squad.
What's the one, you mentioned it in the book, I think, it's Cagney, is it The Fighting 69th? Is that the title of the film?
That's a slightly pre-warish movie, but I know where you're going, and you're right. Yeah, it's
Cagney's in that, yeah. in that category.
Oh, utterly. That's almost the...
And it's Father, whatever, played by Pat O'Brien.
Pat O'Brien.
Who pulls him back into...
well, that combination,
the normative,
they made
the normative
about seven or eight movies together. That yeah. combination was always, Jim Cagney was always the raging id.
Yeah.
And Pat O'Brien, who might be a priest, often was a priest, but he might just be an older brother. And he was always the superego. Mm-hmm. And the conflict was, can the superego control the id before the id, who is always seen as somewhat destructive, before the id goes totally crazy? And, of course, being movies of that time, the superego always taught the id the right lesson.
It just occurs to me, another variant of the very same was set in Boys Town in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Spencer Tracy as Father Flanagan.
That's right.
And Mickey Rooney is the rebellious.
That's right.
Delinquent kid.
That's right, who they have to civilize. And interesting that they were always Irish, huh, Mickey mm-hmm. Rooney. And I think the Celtic temperament perhaps made, I don't know, Hollywood nervous or something. Or they were the most recent immigrants and therefore in most need of American civilization or some such.
When you think about the films that flourished during the war, there were, of course, films of the sort that we've been talking about that deal directly with American military yeah. in war. There are also, as you point out, you have a whole chapter on this, the films about the enemy.
Yeah.
And then there are the historic films, which relates to what we're going through during the war years.
They become metaphors.
They become metaphors.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right. I think those... to me, it was interesting that during the war, there were obviously two wars. There was the European War, and there was the war in the Pacific. And the movies about the Pacific War really were combat movies. I mean, we were hand-to-hand and face-to-face with the Japanese, as we were in reality on December 8th.
What were some of the leading ones about the Pacific War?
Oh, Gung Ho, Bataan, things like the Purple Heart.
Wake Island.
Wake Island was an early one.
Yeah.
The Japanese were uniformly portrayed as monstrous. And monstrous in just the way the horror movie monsters are. They're unpredictable. They are they will kill you without warning and without civility.
I know your country well. I went to college at Stanford.
That's or I flew airplanes in Glendale. That's God is my co-pilot.
Right.
Those little tropes that got, they weren't always used as much, but somehow one movie was all it took to put those into our heads forever, you know. Although I think the guy who, you know, studied aviation at your UCLA, that turned up in two or three movies. But the point is, the Germans, oddly enough, were always portrayed as very civilized people who had been led astray by this single monster, Hitler. There was good to be found in Germans in these war movies.
Now make that
there
case.
Was never good to be found in the Japanese.
Where do we find good German military in war movies?
Almost all of them. I mean, take a figure like the one Cedric Hardwick plays in The Moon Is Down.
The German commandant in an occupied Norwegian town.
That's right. And he's very weary, and he wants these people not to put themselves to the trouble because he's going to have to torture and kill them. And he would prefer not to do that. He would not prefer not to have a firing squad and kill all the leading male citizens of the town. And he has these very civilized speeches where he's trying to persuade them in a gentle way. Hey, God, you know, this is the Third Reich. It's going to last 1,000 years. You can't come. What are you doing here? Similarly, Walter Slezak in...
Lifeboat?
No, he's meaner in Lifeboat.
Yeah.
The Moon Is Down. Not The Moon Is Down. It's one movie with Charles Laughton and Maureen O'Hara. It's a movie about a little French town where Slezak takes over the town.
Yeah.
And This Land Is Mine is the title of the movie. And he's similarly civilized, weary. Von Stroheim in the Samuel Goldwyn movie about the heroic Russian peasants. You know, these are very civilized men. There's no such representation of any Japanese officer in those movies. The Japanese officer's sneering, contemptuous. Yeah.
Possibly later, The Bridge on the River Kwai.
But
who's a human being? A tricked up one.
I guess he is a human being. Yeah. Well, British soldier, be happy in your work. I don't know how civilized he is. Yeah. The point of that is that the Alec Guinness character thinks he can treat him as a civilized human being. He's always going in there to persuade him and ends up in, you know, the hot box.
We've got a scene from a great movie that came in the war, which involves an American and a Nazi in confrontation. And what that is will be revealed right after we pause for these words. Our guest tonight is the distinguished film critic, film scholar, film biographer,
documentarian.
Documentarian and memoirist now with his new book, Good Morning, Mr. Zip Zip Dip. That's Richard Schickel we're talking about, of course. The subtitle of the new book, Movies, Memory, and World War II. It's published by Ivan R.D., the very distinguished publishing firm based right here in Chicago. Well, when it comes to great war movies, when it comes to great American movies, we have, of course, the one we're about to take a scene from, Casablanca. What's your own aesthetic judgment of the total film?
Oh, I utterly love the movie. I
mean, everybody does.
Who doesn't? I've never run into anybody who doesn't like Casablanca, which isn't always true of great movies. I mean, you can run into lots of people who say, I don't like Gone with the Wind. I'm actually one of them. I'm personally not fond of The Wizard of Oz, which I know makes me into a minority. But this is a movie that is utterly lovable. And
how does it work so well?
Well, you know, Umberto Eco said, and I think he may be onto something here, he said that this is a movie that actually processes in one single film every emotional cliche of all movies leading up to its moment. And it is like a great epic that encompasses, and it is very, it's not this particularly long film, but that in its completeness, sort of disarms all criticism. I think that's a fair representation of what Eco was saying about this movie. And I think he's right. You know, I mean, it's a war movie, but at the same time, it is bringing into this single framework all the romantic tropes of previous movies, lost love and not lost love, heroism that arises out of a person who at first is feeling anti-heroic. The sub-characters are genially corrupt, or they're really evil, like the Nazis, or they're gallant in the way that Paul Henreid is, you mm-hmm. know, as the resistance leader. I mean, it's a wonderful movie, and it's funny. It's one of those movies I never tire of. It's the same as with Yankee Doodle Dandy for me. I never tire of seeing Yankee Doodle Dandy. I've probably seen it 12 or 15 times in my life, maybe more.
Well, here's a scene coming up. And here the evil Nazi is Konrad Veidt. He's Colonel somebody. I forget what his name is. Do you remember?
Strasser?
Colonel Strasser or Strasser or something.
Right.
And he's visiting Rick's place,
mm-hmm.
Rick's Cafe in Casablanca, and here's their encounter.
Rick, this is Major Heinrich Strasser of the Third Reich.
How do you do, Mr. Rick?
Oh, how do you do?
And you already know Herr Heinz of the Third Reich?
Please join us, Mr. Rick.
We are very honored tonight, Rick. Major Strasser is one of the reasons the Third Reich enjoys the reputation it has today.
You repeat Third Reich as though you expected there to be others.
Well, personally, Major, I will take what comes.
Do you mind if I ask you a few questions? Unofficially, of course.
Make it official, if you like.
What is your nationality?
I'm drunkard.
And that makes Rick a citizen of the world.
I was born in New York City, if that'll help you any.
I understand that you came here from Paris at the time of the occupation.
There seems to be no secret about that.
Are you one of those people who cannot imagine the Germans and their beloved Paris?
Not particularly my beloved Paris.
Can you imagine us in London?
When you get there, ask me.
Diplomatist.
How about New York?
Well, there are certain sections of New York, Major, that I wouldn't advise you to try to invade.
Uh-huh. Who do you think will win the war?
I have the slightest idea.
Rick is completely neutral about everything, and that takes in the field of women, too.
You are not always so carefully neutral. We have a complete dossier on you. Richard Blaine, American, age 37, cannot return to his country. The reason is a little vague. We also know what you did in Paris, Mr. Blaine, and also we know why you left Paris. Don't worry, we are not going to broadcast it.
Oh, my eyes really brown.
You will forgive my curiosity, Mr. Blaine. The point is, an enemy of the Reich has come to Casablanca, and we are checking up on anybody who can be of any help to us.
Well, my interest in whether Victor Laszlo stays or goes is purely a sporting one.
In this case, you have no sympathy for the fox, huh?
Not particularly. I understand the point of view of the hound, too.
Victor Laszlo published the foulest lies in the Prague newspapers until the very day we marched in it. Even after that, he continued to print scandal sheets in the cellar.
Of course, one must admit he has great courage.
I admit he is very clever. Three times he slipped through our fingers. In Paris, he continued his activities. We intend not to let it happen again.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Your business is politics. Mine is running a saloon.
Good evening, Mr. Blaine.
You see, Major, you have nothing to worry about, Rick.
Perhaps.
Superbly written and acted.
And let us not forget the wonderfully silken performance by Claude Rains,
who's
kind
exactly.
of the interlocutor in that sequence. Sure, I could listen to that forever, and I think most people of our age and younger. I mean, it is the one war movie that there's a fair chance your children and grandchildren will have seen voluntarily. Not, you know, one of us throwing the tape into the deck and saying, you watch this, you really like it.
There's another great presence in the film. Was this the first American, the first film that Sidney Greenstreet did in Hollywood?
No, because he was notable a year, 2 years earlier in
Maltese Falcon.
Maltese Falcon.
That came earlier.
As Gutman.
Of course,
know,
yes.
That was really a very, I think, a richer performance, because it kind of runs more through the whole picture.
That's a film, too, one could see again.
Oh, well. Yeah, that's a very, very good movie.
And again, Bogart's right in the middle.
Bogart.
Of that
one. Bogart was made, been around Hollywood for quite a while, but largely in B-movies and small parts in A-movies. You can see him in about two scenes in Dark Victory, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But he made a picture called High Sierra with Raoul Walsh, which began putting him over. This is pre-war. Then came Maltese Falcon, which really did big things for him. And then he did Across the Pacific, which was intended as a kind of sequel, at least repaired him and Mary Astor.
Green Street and Mary Astor.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then came Casablanca. I may have left out some minor movies mm-hmm. there, but those are big movies for him. And they made him a star, a huge star, after a long, and in Bogart's case, very impatient wait for stardom.
The movie-loving kid in Milwaukee, going to the movies a lot, as the war was playing through, and of course beyond the war, which actors were figural for you? Which ones did you sort of invest your own fantasies
well,
in?
Well, actually, Bogart, really, truly. An actor people don't think a great deal about now, but I thought was wonderful at the time, John Garfield.
Mm-hmm.
Cagney. I like City Kids, apparently. You know, these are kind of real urban types. And to be honest, looking back, there are studios that I thought made better pictures than the other studios.
Warner Brothers
notably.
Yeah.
But also I think about these two kind of fringe major studios, Columbia and RKO, where they were so, in the case of RKO, they were so totally, you know, on their asses that they kind of would take a chance on all kinds of strange, interesting movies like Citizen Kane. And Columbia was run by, you know, the outrageous Harry Cohn. And I don't know if you could even categorize his taste, but because you couldn't categorize him, he would do some interesting movies. And two of the wartime movies that I think very well of, kind of little B movies. I ran one of them at the Siskel Center last night called Address Unknown. And here's what's interesting about those movies.
Is that the one with Paul Lucas?
Yeah.
Adressat und Bekommt.
Huh?
It's from a story originally titled in German, Adressat und Bekommt.
Uh-huh.
It's revenge of certain Jewish refugees upon their persecutors.
One Jewish refugee's son in particular.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a wonderfully tricky story, but it is one of the two or three American movies that took up the subject of what was happening to European Jewry at that time during the war. There's a representation in Address Unknown of Kristallnacht. There's a story of a man coming to Germany from America who was born in Germany and being seduced by the Nazis into a kind of, he's kind of like, they play him as if he could be an aristocrat, but what they want to do is use him. I think it's a terrific movie. It's 72 minutes long. But the main point about that movie to me is that it at least represents, not in its full horror, of course, what is going on with Jews in that time. And it came out of Columbia. Most American studios, and I think it's worth saying because it's a theme in my book, most American movies at that time, even though Hollywood was largely managed by Jewish people, the Office of War Information didn't want them to talk about this topic.
But don't you agree also that some of those Jewish producers and the Jewish studio heads themselves were very inhibited? The theme was, in a way, don't make waves.
Oh, sure. But that was true also.
Don't call attention to ourselves.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's the Neil Gabler thesis. You know, they became more American, even though they were immigrants for a large part. They became more American than the native-born Americans, and they presented a vision of American happiness and contentment and loving sweetness.
Were there a large Jewish presence at the actor and director level as well as at the production and management
there were
level?
A number of Jewish actors.
John Garfield was. Originally, his name was Garfinkel.
And there were others. Certainly, the guy playing opposite Paul Lucas, and this was Morris Karnofsky.
He's a great Yiddish language actor.
Yeah. Yes, and there were a few Jewish directors. George Cukor would be a good example of that. But, no, I wouldn't think that it was quite as free to be a performing. Well, hey, maybe I'm wrong. Al Jolson, a lot of the comedians, of course, Eddie Cantor, so forth had had long careers before that. I think, though, that there was at that point and subsequently, and there were articles at the time, there was a real downplaying of Jewish ethnicity in movies during the war. Whereas prior to that, you know, the Marx Brothers or whoever, even Jim Cagney, they would crack jokes that betrayed their ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a useful and good thing that happened. And then in the war they said, well, we better not do this. So I think that's kind of a scandal. I mean, even though, as you say, there was a sort of don't make waves attitude in general in Hollywood, I do think they were seduced by the Office of War Information. I think that those guys said, look, we got surveys that show that 50% of America is anti-Semitic. They will not fight a war to save Jewish lives in Europe. Therefore, we'll make the war about something else.
Did they actually have data of that sort?
Apparently. I have read it in a couple of studies of influence of the wartime relationship between the studios and the government.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, they did have that kind of thing. And yet, you know, at the very same time, Ben Hecht was putting on his pageants here in Chicago and New York and Los Angeles, and huge venues, Madison Square Garden, with movie stars, and was talking about the millions of Jewish dead in the concentration camps. So he knew, anybody who went to his pageant would know, and yet, you know, everybody said, no, well, we're not talking about that. And the movies did not talk about that.
There are some things they didn't talk about that were happening. There were some things they talked about that never happened. And particularly in their treatment of our great ally, the Soviet Union.
It's kind of a little bit of a myth that there was a lot of pro-Soviet films made at the time.
Well, you treat
there were four or five of them.
And you treat those in this book. One was the one based upon the memoirs of our ambassador to Moscow.
Was the most notorious of them, Mission to Moscow.
Played by Walter Huston.
Walter Huston.
What was his name in real life?
Joseph Davies.
Joseph Davies.
He was a corporate lawyer and a Middle Westerner. And if you may have noticed in the book, my grandfather was proud to have known him. They were in the same law school class in Wisconsin. And Davies was really just totally taken over by Stalin and his henchmen. And
he was an easy dupe, in fact.
Yeah, an easy dupe. All these guys were tough corporate lawyers who like to lead us into Middle Eastern wars and stuff. They aren't as smart as they think they are. And he wasn't as smart about Stalin as he thought he was.
I remember an incredible one. I forget its title, though. You do mention it in the book, in which Gregory Peck, of all people, is a peasant guerrilla leader.
That's right. And I've forgotten the title, too. There was that. There was the North Star, the Sam Goldwyn movie that Lillian Hellman wrote that was about the peasants standing up.
Well, I think that's the one. I think that's where Gregory Peck...
No, that's Gregory Peck's not in that one. Farley Granger's in that
Farley
one.
Farley Granger.
Andrews. The Gregory Peck one I've sort of forgotten. There were about four movies that you could label overtly Soviet-supportive propaganda, which is piddling considering that they made in those days... 300-400 movies a year. I think, though, the rhetoric of the Popular Front was used all over Hollywood movies. It's the little guy, what now kind of rhetoric, which Philip Roth is quite actually moving and funny about in I Married a Communist. Or which I think was an execrable taste and sort of stupefying to listen to. But to me as a kid, I thought, well, gee, maybe that's how really sophisticated grown-ups talk about the war.
Well, we need to talk about, get to something that is worked throughout this book, namely your sense that though the films were utterly captivating and they shaped your consciousness, they also kind of created what the Marxists would call a false consciousness.
That's true.
And we'll proceed with all of that, but first we go to the newsroom and to Jim Anthony. And we return to Richard Schickel. We are drawing from or talking about his new book, Good Morning, Mr. Zip, 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 Movies, Memory, and World War II. It's a wonderfully readable book.
Well, thank you.
The way
I worked hard to make it that way.
but it flows in a rather effortless way. It's like having a good conversation.
That's good.
And the book is published by Ivan R. D. But I mentioned just before we took that news break that one overall theme is that given the naivete of the little boy in Milwaukee, mm-hmm. that grew up to be a bigger boy and then went to University of Wisconsin where he became, I think, editor of the Cardinal, the student newspaper.
Well, not quite, but I was an executive
editor. Busy guy at the Cardinal.
Like that, yeah.
And on into other things. But that during those war years and even beyond, the films gave you a reassuring and a gratifying and an exciting kind of reality which countered the humdrum reality in which you existed.
Yeah, I think that was really important, yeah.
But that they also sold you a lot of distortions.
Yeah.
Maybe even some outright lies.
Yeah, I think... To take the first part of the question, I think it was a wonderful place in one sort of way to grow up in Wauwatosa. It was mm-hmm. safe, it was secure, it was benign. I can't believe that there was any major capital crimes going on. I never heard of any, certainly when I was growing up.
There were two sex scandals.
There were a couple of sex scandals. Both, interestingly enough, involving high school teachers. All of that. But at the same time, it was a little dull. And I think that some part of me, it's the same part that listened avidly to adventure shows on the radio, the same part of me that went and got historical novels by Kenneth Roberts or Walter Edmonds.
Along the Mohawk is when
wonderful book, yes.
And a great film.
Wonderful
made
film,
by John Ford.
Ford film, yeah. All of those things were an attempt to sort of enliven my imagination, you know, to take me out of there out of this sort of dull routine life that we had. On the other hand, a lot of movies of the war years, and let me summarize it this way. The subject they funked, really, were two. The first we've already discussed, the whole question of anti-Semitism in Europe. And it wasn't anti-Semitism, it was racial murder, which they did not discuss. Those movies, we had sort of surrogates for us fighting in the European theater. In other words, we didn't engage with the Nazis till North Africa in 1942. So there are lots and lots of movies about the underground in Europe. And yet that underground certainly never had any Jews in it. It certainly never had any interesting enough communists in it. Whereas, as we know now, the communists in Europe were perhaps leading figures in the underground. They had a commitment that, say, democratic socialists and liberals mm-hmm. and so forth didn't have to fight the Nazis in that way. But the other big question that the movies failed to address was simply death. Okay, here you are, little kid, you know, standing on a street corner, 11 years old, maybe, or 12, and 50 million people are dying in the world around him. And he has no real conception of that. Yes, there are casualty lists in the paper, and that's fine. And sometimes there are people who, if not known to you, are known to you by the second or third remove. But there is no attempt to sort of total up the casualties. You know, put the casualties together of, say, the Blitz and Iwo Jima and D-Day and say, this is major what's going on here. There's certainly no attempt to talk about carpet bombing Hamburg or firestorms over Dresden. This whole question of death was resolved in the movies in this way. You would see a Spencer Tracy or a John Wayne. He could die in a movie, but he would have to die in such a way that his image would be seen going up into the clouds in heaven.
So remembering the perfect death of John Wayne in The Sands of Iwo Jima.
Yeah, sure, exactly.
You remember that last scene? How does it go?
I don't remember vividly. He takes a bulldozer and drives it toward the Japanese who are holding out and preventing him from building his airfield or whatever the hell he's doing. And it's a martyr's death, but it is also understood to be a death that will be heroic, will be remembered, will be honored throughout
the trope that
time.
Ends that film is that the guys gather around,
yeah,
and then they decide, we got to get back to work, it's in his name.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's correct. And there's a lot of that going on in these movies.
Sure.
I mean, there's a wonderful death scene in Air Force where, you know, the captain of the B-17 dies. And, you know, the guys stand there for a minute. And literally, Harry Carey, who's the crew chief, says, okay, guys, back to work. You know, a lot to do, something like that, just as you said. That, the point is, death is always transcended by its alleged meaning in terms of the greater cause that we were all fighting
it's
for.
What suddenly remembers the Dylan Thomas line, death shall have no dominion.
Yeah, death shall have no dominion in World War II combat movies made during World War II.
Exactly.
And I think that's a terrible lie to propagate to people. I mean, in other words, I think you have to say about a war that people will die absurdly. They will die for no particular good reason except they happen to be standing in the wrong place when the daisy cutter came down. Or they will be in the wrong city when Bomber Harris decides that that's the city he's going to carpet bomb. And I think we must, you know, I'm not sentimental. I don't want to make a pacifist position here. What I'm trying to make is kind of an existential position that, you know, death is something that has to be dealt with in a more realistic fashion than these movies did. It is usually not, especially in wartime. It's not always or usually heroic. It is not something that we are going to, that these names are going to live forever. I mean, Sam Fuller was a wonderful film director who landed on three beachheads in Europe. He said, look, soldiers have only one thought. That's to live, live, live. They don't have any glorious ideas about it. They don't have any heroic ideas about it. They just want to live. And I think, you know, there's not enough of that attitude. The other thing they will, soldiers will fight for their comrades. That's the largest, those two are the largest motives for military action on an individual basis.
There's another great sector of human need, human imagination, and human fulfillment and loss, that is love,
mm-hmm,
and the relations between man and woman,
or between men and men in these
days,
movies. I meant in terms of buddy comradeship.
Oh, to be sure,
You know, I mean, I think people will in wartime lay down their lives for their friend, almost just instinctively. For mm-hmm. their friend in a tight spot.
But turning to, you know, the realm of romance or the realm of the longings of young people for one another.
Yeah.
What did you learn as a kid going to the movies in Milwaukee that turned out to be true? What did you learn that tilted you in the wrong direction?
That's a good question. I think I learned. I mean, there are a couple of movies that come almost immediately to mind. The first is quite a wonderful movie, I think, by Vincent Minnelli called The Clock.
Mm-hmm. With Judy Garland.
Judy Garland and Robert Walker. And he's a kid from some farm country who briefly in New York, I think he has a 24-hour, 48-hour pass. And he meets Judy Garland in Grand Central Station. And before the end of the movie, they have courted, they have married. In haste, they have begun to repent the hasty marriage. They patch it up, and she sees him off to the train. And the movie leaves you in a kind of nice ambivalent state because they have already had troubles in this little relationship. So, you know, will she be there for him when he comes marching back from war? Will he march back from war at all, or will he die in a foxhole somewhere or other? I think that movie, about as well as any, captures the essential ambivalences of romance in wartime. And I remember, you know, I remember my mother in particular talking about it. I mean, should these kids get married now and have at least a few days or weeks or months of happiness before he goes away? And will that mean that there's a young widow and perhaps a young widow and an orphan? Or, you know, do they, you know... It's poised often enough in wartime movies.
Excuse me, quite apart from war films, though, the representation of falling in love and of what follows thereupon,
mm-hmm.
as we get it in film, we get it in other mass media entertainments as well, thematic entertainments, but particularly in film. That has shaped, in a way, the aspirations and maybe even the courtship behaviors of generations of Americans.
I, you know, respectfully, I'm not sure. I think romance at this kind of simple level that movies and popular fiction deal with it.
Well, they had it that way then. They no longer do. Now it's reduced to a far more barbarous and cynical sort of sport.
I mean, look, there are popular novels by people like Anita Shreve and so forth that appear to take up some of these same issues in much the same terms. You know, what I'm saying, I think, is that wartime takes the basic romantic issue and puts it under heavy pressure, you know, heavy narrative pressure, because there are deadlines, there are passes that will... And
there are other obligations. We can go back to Casablanca and what and the continuing love between Rick and... what's her name? The Bergman part. Elsa? But it cannot be honored.
No. And, you know, it doesn't take any wise guy to say that we don't amount to more than a hill of beans, considering the vast issues of mega geographic issues that are, you know, impinging on their romance. So he has to see her off on the plane with Victor Laszlo. But I think that's the point, isn't it? That's a romance that if war were not present, they could work it out in some decent, civilized way.
Sure.
You know, probably Victor Laszlo would bow out and, you know, go back to running his newspaper, whatever the thing he did in peacetime was, and these two people would allow themselves. But, you know, you mentioned before, for the far, far better thing, it is a far, far better thing for Rick to give her up.
By the way, we've got to go to commercial in just a minute, but would you like to hear, staying with Casablanca, we happen to have it in the can, the very last scene after he puts her on the plane?
Oh, sure.
The famous
scene with Claude Rains.
Scene with Claude Rains.
Right,
here it is.
What was the meaning of that phone call? Victor Laszlo is on that plane. Why do you stand here? Why don't you stop him? Ask Mr. Rick.
Get away from the phone. I would advise you not to interfere.
I was willing to shoot Captain Rano, and I'm willing to shoot you.
Hello.
Put that phone down.
Get me the radio tower.
Put it down.
Major Strasser has been shot.
Round up the usual suspects.
We must have to get.
Well, Rick, you're not only a sentimentalist, but you've become a patriot.
Harvey, but it seemed like a good time to start.
I think perhaps you're right.
It might be a good idea for you to disappear from Casablanca for a while. There's a free French garrison over at Brazzaville. I could be induced to arrange a passage.
My letter of transit? I could use a trip. If it doesn't make a difference about our bet, you still owe me 10,000 francs.
And that 10,000 francs should pay our expenses.
Our expenses?
Mm-hmm.
Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Round up the usual suspects. I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Those are lines that live forever.
They do resonate, don't they?
We've got some commercials to take care of. It is time as well to invite telephone calls. Anything you'd like to ask or remember with us, 591-7200 is the number, 591-7200. And if you'd rather reach us via email. That's particularly handy for listeners on the Internet at some distant location or in another country. You can get to us at extension 720, one word, at tribune.com. Extension 720 at tribune.com or 591-7200. We return to Richard Schickel directly after these words. And we will shortly be going to the phones. The number is 591-7200, 591-7200. And if you're calling us from some great distance, or rather if you're at some great distance and would like to reach us via email, that is also easily done. The email address, extension 720 at tribune.com. And with that, let's go to the first caller. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, Milt, I was just calling to share with you, and I'd like to hear Mr. Schickel's comments about some of my favorite movies. I happen to be a Vietnam veteran, and so a lot of these World War II movies, I when I was a kid, I grew up watching,
mm-hmm.
and kind of inspired me when I was in the service. I listed five of them here. First one was Battleground.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the combat scene.
Yeah, it's not strictly speaking World War. It wasn't made during World War II, as you know. It was made about...
I think it was about 2 or 3 years
yeah,
after.
Yeah, right.
The Five Sullivan, which shows how the death of family members can affect the family.
Mm-hmm.
The movie G.I. Joe with Ernie Pyle. And
yeah, it's a great movie, I think.
Ernie Pyle and starred Robert Mitchum and mm-hmm. Burgess Meredith.
It's a movie that made Mitchum a movie star, actually.
And They Were Expendable.
Great movie.
Shows how we were on the defensive.
Yeah. That I believe, am I right in this, Richard, that was a John Ford film.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very strong list of films you've made because, with the one exception, I happen not to care particularly for the Sullivan, the Fighting Sullivans, as it was called. I think it had another title as well. But the other movies you named are, in fact, the combat movies that, in my book, I single out as, I think, exceptional movies. And, you know, Story of G.I. Joe and They Were Expendable, though they were made during the war, weren't released until after the war. But by that time, I think there was an impulse in Hollywood to show the in a very plain-spoken way, the dutifulness of Americans, of American soldiers, just getting on with it, doing their job, not making a deal out of it. As you'll recall, the very end of G.I. Joe, the Mitchum character, who we have come to identify with and like very much because he's a humane lieutenant leading his platoon, is dead. And nothing is made of it. He is a body slung over a mule in the back of the shot. And a couple of guys in front mentioned he's died. They Were Expendable is about, you know, a PT boat squadron based on a true story, retreating in the face of the Japanese onslaught in the Philippines. And, you know, that squadron is one by one decimated. One boat after another is disabled, one man after another is disabled or killed, and yet they fight on and, you know, almost with a shrug. Well, this is what we do, this is what we have to do. I think those movies represent service and heroism of a kind in a very, to me, heartening and inspiring way. So I think very highly of those movies, and I kind of congratulate you for knowing those movies because they are not, by any means, amongst the most famous movies of World War II.
There's one more movie I'd like to mention.
Yeah.
And that's the one that won the Academy Award for Best Picture. It was after the war. I can't remember the name of it. It was with Danny Andrews.
Best Years of Our Lives.
Best Years of Our Lives.
Yeah. I happen not to care for that movie particularly. I feel it's kind of the last gasp of sort of New Deal good feelings. Nonetheless, there are some performances. There's something about it that I don't quite believe. It's realistic in its tonalities, but it's not realistic in its emotionality, if you will. So I'm not as high on that one as other people are. That's a minority opinion, by the way, on my part. Most people like that movie. They remember it fondly. There's something about it, though, that to me simply doesn't ring true. But the other movies you mentioned, and Battleground, which was made after the war, is a pretty good combat movie. You know, again, uncomplaining soldiers fighting their way through the Battle of the Bulge. It's pretty well done.
Sarah, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. How do you compare those films to those that have been made retrospectively looking back to World War II? We've had many.
Mm-hmm.
A major one of just a few years ago, of course, is Saving Private Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been so many others.
Which I think is a wonderful movie.
Yeah. But do they treat the war differently? Seems to me they do.
Well, I think a lot of the movies after World War II, in the immediate aftermath, that reverted to the war. Of course, during the 60s, when Vietnam was on, we didn't see any World War II movies. They were mostly kind of idle, heroic movies, I think. I think it required us to digest Vietnam and then go back, you know, with a movie like Private Ryan or more terrible still, Schindler's List, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it required experience, you know, and history to just pass before we could kind of come to grips with that movie, except for the exceptions the gentleman named on in his phone call, because there were these kind of couple of pioneering movies that were really very good on the subject of authentic heroism.
Of course, we treated the Vietnam War far more cynically and representing it as a far more brutal, unjustifiable conflict from the very beginning of Vietnam films, I think.
I think so, although during the war there was, you know, there was a movie that wasn't much attended to at the time. It's called Go Tell the Spartans, which kind of reconstituted the old World War II platoon under pressure genre. And again, it was decently heroic. It was not flag-wavingly heroic. But most of the movies about Vietnam during the war, they tended to be kind of like the John Wayne Green Berets kind of movie. I mean, I'm not a great admirer of Platoon or... I think the best Vietnam War movie was Full Metal Jacket, Stanley Kubrick's movie.
Yeah.
I think that got at some kind of horror and madness in a way that the other movies didn't.
The first portion of it, the Marine training thing.
Oh, that's horrible. Beyond belief.
we go to the newsroom in a moment for an update from Paula Cooper and from ABC Network. Our guest tonight is Richard Schickel. We are drawing from his new delightful memoir, if delightful isn't the word, nostalgic memoir, if nostalgic isn't the word.
Searching
memoir. That's it.
How do you like that?
And that's the word I've been searching for, in fact. And it is titled, Good Morning, Mr. Zip, 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 Movies, Memory, and World War II. Ivan R.D., the publisher. 591-7200 is our number, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, I'm dealing with the great screenwriters of the 40s. With the exception of Charlie Kaufman today,
mm-hmm.
Is there anyone today that even compares to the genius of a Joe Mankiewicz, a Billy Wilder, or a Jan Houston? Because I don't see it.
You left out Preston Sturges back
right.
then.
Right. But, I mean, outside of Charlie Kaufman.
Well,
today,
I don't
is
know
there
about
Charlie.
Yeah, sure. Robert Towne, to name one.
Yeah, but he was big in the 70s. Has he done anything lately?
Well, I just recently read the screenplay for his movie that he's hoping to direct. And it's a brilliant screenplay.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he has to make a... Look, you know, everybody has to make a living.
Of course.
You know, especially screenwriters. And it's not the easiest dollar in the world, I must say. So, did you have a question?
No, I just don't think the writing talent is as good as it was in the
40s. I think people don't write screenplays anymore in the way that Joe Mankiewicz did or Houston did, with real attention to nuances of dialogue. I mean, even some of the stuff we're playing here on off Casablanca, you couldn't write that today. They'd say, well, that's fine, but we don't want that. We want to. So what screenwriters do nowadays is they structure movies. They don't write movies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a premium on writing in the way that, you know, those were screenplays.
You couldn't have that extended dialogue between Strasser and Rick and...
No, because the camera would be too restless.
And it's time to shoot them.
Yeah, right, and it's time to move it on, and let's cut.
Special effects.
I mean, it does take... No, and well, they had special effects in those days, but they were not the major feature of the movie. Yeah. So all of those things factor into a diminution, I think, of screenwriter prestige and, in a way, screenwriter power.
Okay.
Ma'am, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
And let's quickly go to another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Yes, hello. Richard Westphal calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
There you go.
And Richard, you and Nancy Olson are some of our famous people who grew up in the area. Listen,
We just received an award from our high school on Monday.
Yeah, I read that. I went to Wauwatosa East for 1 year and
there you go.
Great school.
Uh-huh.
Listen, years ago when you did The Man Who Made the Movies,
yeah.
I thought that was the best documentary series I ever saw.
Gee, a lot of people love that. I've redone four of those. Are you aware of that?
No, I'm not.
I re-edited them, and they appear intermittently on Turner Classic Movies, but they're finally the way I wanted them to be. And I added a fifth one about Sam Fuller, and they're all... You know, from time to time available on Turner Classics. And we hope soon to have them out on DVD and video.
I wanted to ask you, I know you do the work for AFI.
Mm-hmm.
And where are they heading? Are they going to do more of those specials?
I haven't worked on an AFI special in a couple of years. I produced and a couple of them, I think it was four or five years ago, when the first series, you know, the 100 best movies.
Right.
I was executive producer of the 10-part series, on Turner Classics. So, yes, but they are doing another one. They're doing this year Heroes and Villains, 50 of each. And I think that'll be on in June.
Well, it's been nice talking to you. And,
yeah.
I enjoy your books and your
great
documentaries.
I hope you'll like Good Morning, Mr. Zip, Zip, Zip.
I'm going to go to the bookstore, definitely.
There you go.
Good night.
Good night,
Jeff.
You.
Thank you for the call. Another film clip. They made war movies not only in this country, but they made them in all the countries that were involved in the war, including Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a few of those after the fact.
And some of those are very interesting, aren't they? Because they're almost like Hollywood genre movies.
Yeah.
There
are also some interesting Japanese ones. I saw one many years later, only within the last 10 years. But it was made during the war, I think, about a lost Japanese squad who were
being
picked off. You know the one I mean?
Yes, I do know that movie.
And they called cannibalism. Very horrific movie.
Yeah, but that's a movie I think came out after the war. I'm not sure it was made during the war.
Quite likely.
Yeah.
But here's one made during the war in England, the great filming of Henry V that Olivier directed and acted in. I've always loved this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Would you count it as one of the great films?
Oh, certainly, maybe still greatest of Shakespeare films.
Yeah.
You know, it's been some years since I've seen it, so I'm going to withhold the judgment.
Yeah.
I can repeat my 11 or 12 year old judgment that I really thought it was an amazing movie, and among the amazements to me were that I could understand it and become emotionally involved in it. I mean, who knew? It was almost certainly the first Shakespeare that I ever saw or heard, and I certainly hadn't read any Shakespeare plays, so it was the first Shakespeare I really experienced.
Well, this could have appealed certainly to a 12-year-old boy in Milwaukee. This is Henry V rallying the troops in the great St. Crispin's Day speech just before they go into the Battle of Agincourt.
Oh, that we now had here but 1/10,000 of those men in England who do not work today.
What's he that wishes so? My cousin Westmoreland? No, my fair cousin. If we are marked to die, we are enough to do our country loss. And if to live, the fewer men, the greater share of honor. God's will, I pray thee, wish not one man more. Rather proclaim it, Westmoreland, through my host, that he which hath no stomach to this feast, let him depart. His passport shall be drawn, and crowns for convoy put into his purse. We would not die in that man's company that fears his fellowship to die with us. This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand a tiptoe when this day is named and rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall live this day and see old age will yearly on the vigil feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is St. Crispian. Then will he slit his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin, say, old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in his mouth as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son. And Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers. For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so base. And gentlemen in England now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhood cheap. While Danny speaks, that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Well,
you would pick up your spear?
Exactly. I mean, it's interesting to hear that in the abstract without the imagery with it. Because, you know, what you are talking about there is essential wartime propaganda.
Sure.
I mean, obviously, this movie was made as a metaphor for World War II and for, you know, opposing a tyrannical European government by the, you know, little country of England, little brave England. But, you know, there is something in that rhetoric that, you know, although it's Shakespearean and thus glorious in a way, you know, the notes it's striking are, look, stand with us, you will be immortal. You will not die, even though you will die on this day, very likely. You will, in a sense, transcend your basic human limitations through heroic behavior. You know, to be bluntly honest, having written this book and all of that, I still don't know if I can. I don't want to condemn this, but I don't want to. Some part of me doesn't want to embrace it either. You know, that the spirit of St. Crispin's Day.
What do you do when you're a commander, and you have to march your men into battle? What do you say to them?
It's a good. Well, if anybody had Shakespeare's imagination, you'd try to say something pretty much like that, wouldn't you? So I wonder today whether that kind of you know, large-scale rhetoric would work with, say, a bunch of GIs, you know.
You remember
it might be like, geez, guys, what's he talking about?
You remember the great line that they use in the Patton film?
Yeah.
Where they have George Scott say, your job as a soldier is to kill the bastard who's trying to kill you.
Right.
That's a very different sort of motivation.
Yeah, and I think it's a truer, maybe, motivation. Yeah. You know, I mean, it goes back to the thing that I quoted Sam Fuller as saying, you know, the idea is to live, live, live. Well, in war, the way to live is to kill the other guy before he kills you.
Exactly.
So, you know, war is a terror. I guess another aspect of what I was saying in Mr. Zip is, you know, war is so much more terrible than its representations, whatever they are, whether they're in a novel or a television show or even a good movie. You know, I don't know of any fictional movie that probably catches the full horror of war. Although I must say the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan probably comes as close to it as any filmed representation of that. And maybe there are a few other similar sequences. But, you know, war is a sustained horror. I mean, you know, it's not just that there's a battle. There is the aftermath of battle, the bloody mopping up. There's the fear that anticipating a battle. All that stuff. You know, movies have variously done well and badly with that those topics. But maybe it's a topic that is beyond movies and beyond, you know, I don't know. I'd have to, it's been a long time since I read Tolstoy and the Battle of Borodino.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that, I seem to recall that as a wonderful rhetorical exercise in conveying the full horror of battle. I don't know, maybe I wouldn't think that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Time for another round of commercials, then back to the phones on 591-7200. And we return to Richard Jekyll. And directly back to your calls for him, after I quickly reassert that his new book is, and it's a wonderful book, I've enjoyed reading it tremendously, is Good Morning, Mr. Zip, 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 Movies, Memory, and World War II. I have a considerable memory for movies, particularly the older ones, and just reading this and getting his reflections on the films related to World War II has been a great charge for me. I want to go see a number of these movies again.
They're hard to see, so, you know.
I suppose.
It's difficult. You have to have a very good video store in your neighborhood, you know. And I was lucky in that respect. I have a good one, and I have a lot of them in stock, and I have a lot of friends who collect videos. And so I was able to see just about everything I wanted to see again. The hardest movie to see was Moon Is Down. I don't know why, but it took me about two, three years to find that video.
Do I remember correctly that, uncharacteristically, that was written by John Steinbeck?
Yes, it was, and he got in a lot of trouble for it because he did present, I mentioned earlier in the show, the slightly sympathetic officer. There's another junior officer who's rather sympathetically presented, and people didn't. They said, wait a minute, these are the enemy. And, you know, it was Steinbeck trying to say, look, they are the enemy, and we must defeat them, and these, and the peasant village is heroic in its opposition to them. But he refused to make them into monsters, you know.
Back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Hi, Mr. Schickel.
Hi.
Did you earlier mention that there were no World War II movies made during the Vietnam War?
Pretty much so, I think.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Well, Milt just earlier mentioned, you know, Patton. And what, did that come out during that era?
Yeah, and that's an interesting movie, isn't it?
Because, it was a great movie.
Yeah, but it is a very... it is very much, I think, a pro-war movie coming out at that time. Although, you know, the movie was so strong, especially in George Scott's performance, I think, that people sort of forgave it bad attitude.
In the college town where I went to school, they showed there was an old movie theater that would show, you know, second run movies after, you know, after first run had expired, and they played a double feature one weekend. It was it was Patton and MASH, so you had you had both extremes.
Right? Yeah. I mean, of the two, I prefer, as a movie, Patton.
Mm-hmm.
Our producer, Barry Regan, suggested another World War II film made during the Vietnam War is Dirty Dozen. Is that right?
Is that right? It seems to me Dirty Dozen was just before the country was so exacerbated by the war. It seems to me it was just a little bit... It was certainly before Nixon and that crowd took the war over.
I mentioned to the producer if Big Red One was made, maybe made during that, or was it?
No, Big Red One was made, as I recall, in 1980.
Okay. One last thing, there was the star of that one, the older guy.
Lee Marvin?
He was in a movie earlier where he played a German during World War One, and he was very anti the German officers. And it was a very good movie, and I think Michael York was in it also.
Well, I've forgotten that one, so
okay.
I can't help you.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Big Red One is, of course, the 1st Division. The one of the former commanders of the 1st Division, General David Grange, is a rather frequent guest on our
program. Oh, really?
Yeah. He is an officer of the McCormick Foundation upstairs.
That's a movie that is radically shortened by the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us keep trying, because we believe the material is there, to restore it at least 90% of what Sam wanted to make, which would be about a three-hour movie as opposed to about a two-hour movie. And we keep working on that. Someday we're going to get it done. But even in its slightly confused, truncated form, it has some incredibly powerful sequences in it. And, you know, I'm going to risk a generalization here. All the great war movies are essentially anti-war movies. You know, movies that wave the bloody flag, jingoistically, tend not to last very well. Whereas movies that take up the subject of war, and they're not necessarily pacifistic, but take them up in some kind of a way that makes you appreciate the horror and terror of war, are the movies that last. So, I mean, an excellent example would be All Quiet on the Western Front.
Yes.
Made in 1931. But, you know, it still has very potent scenes in it.
But, you know, I just thought of a variant. This is not to do a yes buff, but it's something a little bit different about war movies at sea.
Uh-huh.
The sea is cleaner, more pristine. Yeah. We have some great films about naval battles, but they are not as grimy as...
Oh, that's absolutely true. You know,
Therefore, they're not as much implicitly in
the war. I think during the war, everybody, you know, really thought it would be better to be a sailor than a soldier or a marine.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I mean, one thing that really must be said about that war, no one wanted to fight the Japanese in the jungles of those tiny islands in the South Pacific.
They were fearful.
That was a brutal war. And if you read, say, E.B. Sledge's memoirs of being a Marine in that war, it is horrific. And, you know, because the Japanese would stand to the last man, we took very few prisoners in that war. Germans would send, you know, they were surrounded as a comrade, and thousands of them would surrender. The Japanese, you know, there would be figures like, you know, 1,000 guys in the engagement, and only 29 or 39 or 49 would surrender. The rest would die. They'd make a bonsai charge, or they'd actually kill themselves, or they would allow themselves to be killed in a hopeless cause.
You remember that epic story, apparently true, of a Japanese soldier who refused to surrender and didn't really believe the war was over.
Oh, it went on for... They found him in a cave 10 years later.
Where was that? Was it on the Philippines or New Guinea?
Maybe Iwo Jima or one of those places. Yeah. Possibly Okinawa.
Oh, but he finally came out... He was a hero when they took him back to Japan.
I have to say, we portrayed the Japanese in a particularly brutal way during the war, in war movies. Mm. But the fact of the matter is, only if you read any memoir of that war...
Yeah.
They were brutal. They were absolutely tenacious, ferocious fighting force.
You reference Iris Chang's The Rape of Nanking.
Yes.
She was on this program at the time that book was published.
That's a great book.
A horrifying great book.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, but look at that. Also, retreating, this is something people don't know about. When they retreated from Manila, they fired the city, you know. And they killed 100,000 people. So, you know, when you come to the whole debate of Nagasaki, Hiroshima, and all that stuff, you have to weigh in the balance the fact that we were dealing with an enemy that was particularly brutal, as brutal to innocents in its way as the Germans were brutal to innocents in their way. And the difference is who represents the people of Asia, the unspoken masses of Asia, millions and millions of them. They don't have relatives in this country, or didn't have. No one spoke for them. So, you know, and I will say about the Germans, you know, they have done mighty atonement in the post-war years, and the Japanese have not yet. So I have, I suppose, that little prejudice against the way they have evaded their war guilt, I guess.
Yeah, that point's been made by others. It's not in the curricula of their educational system.
Apparently not.
They don't teach
that's right.
what they really did in the war.
That's correct.
Whereas the Germans
obsessively do that.
Let's work in one or two more quick calls. Here's another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes.
Getting back to a subject that you discussed a few minutes ago, regarding screenwriters, perhaps one of the big differences is the audience that they're pitching the movies to these days are older teenagers and people in their 20s.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And these are people basically, I'm going to generalize and I'll probably get hit over the head with it, with not much depth compared to the adult audience that the people in the 40s.
I would say that over the course of a year, Hollywood maybe makes a dozen movies that are actually pitched to adults. There
right.
are some movies for the audience you're talking about that an adult can actually be amused by. but not very many of them. And I mean, you're utterly right. I have nothing. I do not disagree with anything you said.
I'm 68 years old.
I find it very difficult these days to go to the average American movie and write a review of it.
Yeah, and we try to see a movie at least one every week.
Yeah, well,
it's hard to find one.
Go see one with subtitles.
We hang out at the Music Box, which is, you wouldn't know about that, but it's an art house in Chicago.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I hang out at a couple of those in Los Angeles.
Yeah, incidentally, this program is absolutely captivating, hanging on every word.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, incidentally, what about Paths of Glory? Would anybody mention that?
I'm a great fan of Stanley Kubrick. It happens to be a movie of his I like. I think it's the movie of his that I like the least, oddly enough. Mm-hmm. It's too clean. It's too tidy. It's just not really getting at the real horror of trench warfare, I think.
Yeah.
Sarah, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're
thank
just
you.
About out of time. But let me just pick up as we end on what you've said. Do you then see movies these days at all that enthuse you as much as some of the ones you write about?
Sure, every once in a while I do, yeah, sure.
What are the last three or four?
Oh, let me think. I don't know if I can do three or four. I liked Chicago. I liked Almodovar's Talk to Her. I liked The Pianist. I mean, these are the Academy Award-winning movies this year. You know, every once in a while, the Academy more or less gets it right. And I thought this year that they did, pretty much. And those three are awfully good movies. And since we're talking about the war, certainly The Pianist is an unheroic view of a man just desperately trying to survive without heroism, without any rhetoric. And I think that's a salutary movie to look at today.
But the stinkers, or at least the... The boring or displeasing ones.
Well, yeah, I didn't care for The Hours. I didn't particularly care for the Charlie Kaufman movie. I kind of liked the Far From Heaven, but I didn't love it. But at least it was a respectable attempt to make a movie. But, you know, those are all movies that come out in October, November, and early December to qualify for the Oscars.
I now figured out why you wrote this book.
Why?
So you could look at all those fine old movies once again.
Well, if you read the book, you will see, you know, and you know, because you have read the book. It's not... I'm very critical of... I would say more critical of those movies than praising of them. But we have left out...
But they're worth talking about.
Well, yeah, but we've left out the movies that aren't about the war directly, but are metaphorically about it. Tree Girls in Brooklyn, Lassie Come Home. You know, those are wonderful movies, which are still easily, pleasantly watchable now.
And you see, writing the book gave you an excuse to get them all out on tape at least.
Sure.
Watch them again.
Absolutely.
And it makes for a wonderful book. Good Morning, Mr. Zip, Zip, Zip by Richard Schickel. Movies, Memory, and World War II, just published by Ivan R.D. If you want to buy it in a hurry, just go to our website and go to the program guide and scroll down to April 2nd. There you'll see the cover of this book. Click on that, and that will take you to Barnes & Noble, who will sell it to you at a discount. And thanks so much for coming, Richard.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's been a great pleasure.